Good evening and welcome to Kanapa Center for the first night of a weekend workshop with Venerable Amy Miller. We're in for a real treat. She's going to be teaching on how to awaken the fully open heart, learning how to put others before ourselves and really make loving kindness part of our lives. And we're really excited about it. Venerable Amy will be with us in just a few minutes. And so just a couple of words before she comes. First of all, if you are completely new to Buddhism, when she comes in, we'll all stand up, and that's just a sign of respect for the teacher and the teachings that she holds. And then if you're used to coming to Kanapa Center, you're familiar with when Geshe Gelug comes, he'll do prostrations, and he asks us to prostrate with him. That's a choice that he makes out of his humility, but it is traditional to wait until the teacher is seated, and then we prostrate. And prostrations are completely voluntary. If this seems strange or uncomfortable to you, there's no need to join in the prostrations. Also, once Venerable Amy is seated, a group of us will come up and we will be offering a mandala to her. And this is a symbolic offering that you do to request teachings, and then you do after teachings to thank the teacher for it. And we'll be offering, let me show you. This funny looking little item represents the universe. It's Mount Meru in the four continents, which is the universe in Tibetan cosmology. And then we will offer a statue of the Buddha, a stupa, and a text, and that's, again, symbolically offering the body, speech, and mind of the Buddha. So that's what we'll be, that's what that's all about. So she will be with us shortly, and the show will begin. Oh, I forgot another important thing. It is our long tradition at Kanapa Center, because we value these teachings so much and find that they are so precious, that we never ask anybody to pay in order to come in and hear the teachings. But of course we have expenses in order to bring a teacher here, and we want to make, you know, a very generous offering to her on top of our expenses of bringing her here. So if you are moved by what you hear, we would welcome any heartfelt donations. There's a box right outside the door. There's a sheet of paper near the door that tells you how to text donations, and you can also go online and make offerings. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. My name is Amy Miller. Just curious, how many are new to me here that have never come to one of my teachings? So I can tell all my old jokes again? Okay, great. No, thank you very much for coming. I was thinking of some centers have been asking me to frame a certain course about responses to today's political situation. And I actually, this one, I forget the title of this course.
Awakening the Fully Open Heart.
And just based on, often we've got a full room of people here, so I don't know if people feel that sometimes in our tradition, bodhicitta and emptiness, bodhicitta and compassion, they sometimes are not the juiciest part of the path for us. And so I find it really essential right now. So that's what we're going to talk about this weekend, and I hope that works for you. I hope you'll get something out of it. We're also going to do, as part of it, a practice, a meditation on Chenrezig that you can take with you. And for me, it's a fantastic way of doing the internal work, so it informs my external practice when I'm out there in the world. How do we want to be with others? And even you could say particularly right now, okay, because a lot of people are fighting with each other and angry. And we're going to talk about why that isn't really a solution. Okay? So I am giving you information based in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And obviously from my own retreat experiences and from my own life experience. If something works for you, great. You may want to pursue a little bit more. check something out. If something doesn't work for you, I would just put it to the side. So we also, do you have the Refuge Bodhicitta prayer? Sometimes we'd start, I just thought that's, or do people know that? Or is there something, that's often, after they did, so I'm not sure if you're familiar with the mandala offering that we just did. Some people, like, what were they just doing? Anybody wondering? So what they do normally, traditionally, in ancient times, for you to get one teaching. I mean, you have a whole weekend now, but for you to get one teaching, you needed to bring your most precious gifts and anything. And people would basically roll all their items and things that they wanted to offer for this teaching into what's called a wish-fulfilling jewel, or just a gem they would offer, like a precious thing like that. So the mandala offering is kind of a symbol of that. You're offering the universe. Mandala is a world system. It's a Sanskrit word. And you're, in a sense, trying to visualize a world system and the most beautiful, radiant things you can imagine. And the best thing to offer is your practice. Your practice. So any kind of faith you have or interest, sincere interest, to work with your mind and get your mind out of a garbage heap into something pleasurable, enjoyable, blissful, fantastic. And to do it for the benefit of others is something that leads you to enlightenment and plants seeds for you to become a fully awakened being, a Buddha. Buddha is a Sanskrit word for fully awake. Fully awake. So what we do is, so the mandala offering, they offer something called body, speech, and mind, as if you're taking your three doors. They say body, speech, and mind. And then they have this ritual set. Where did it disappear to? It's okay. It's okay. Don't worry. But you see this thing that looks like a wedding cake over here on the right? So that's actually a more elaborate mandala, more elaborate one. And what they did is they offered this first disc that had four towers on it with a fifth one in the middle. And the reason they do it that way is it doesn't spill if you're offering it to the teacher. Because when you have something like that, they used to be made with rings with rice inside. I spilled one in the middle of a big ritual once. Right? It happens. Okay? So this way you don't spill it. It has a tail on it, you saw, that has, oh, it's over there. Okay. Maybe it is a good thing to, because some people never know what these things are. They're like, what are they doing? Some ritual thing. Thank you, Donna.
My pleasure.
I feel like, you know, I don't know, I'm dating myself, but any of you ever watched years ago, thank you very much. The what was the show? Let's Make a Deal. Was it Let's Make a Deal? And they had, no, that's good. Carol Merrill was the one who has the lovely box on the floor. You could trade things for, you know. Thank you, Donna. Okay. This is called a Torma Mandala. It's got these five things that represent the universe. Mount Meru in the center, and there's four continents. Mount Meru is the center of Buddhist cosmology. The four continents are, we are the southern continent, Zambuling, like that. So you offer the mandala from your heart if you're making the offering. And usually the main people from the center make it, or volunteers and things like that. Then it has this tail that goes over your shoulder. So the tail is five different colors, as you can see. White, red, blue, yellow, green, that represent the five Buddha families. Same reason that the prayer flags are those five colors. Okay? And they represent five different Buddhas, five different aspects of the enlightened mind. And each of those Buddhas transforms a certain delusion. And therefore you develop a certain wisdom. There's five wisdoms. And they represent different aggregates of body and mind that are transformed. So at some point you can read that in some of the books. But that's what this represents. If you really want to get elaborate, this can be braided. It's usually braided, all of this, like that. But this is fine like that. And then they have a Buddha statue that represents the body, and they have these very nicely tied up the way they're supposed to be. This represents offering, you know, imagining all the statues that you're offering to, bodies of Buddhas, like that. The text, this is Tibetan texts, are like this. They don't have bindings like our books normally. and they have book covers, and they're read like this. And this would represent the speech, the spoken words you offer, and then this little stupa, like the one, the big one you have outside, represents the mind of the Buddha, the mind of enlightenment. So you would offer these, and these get offered from the crown, the body, speech, and mind, to the teacher. And then, like that, so that's, and then you're saying at the end, please accept this offering to the teacher, please accept this offering so I can get a teaching. And then the last thing we do is refuge in bodhicitta before the teachings. Most of you are probably aware of that from Geshe-la, like that, you probably do those with Geshe-la. Thank you very much. Thank you, Donna. Thank you, Donna, for arranging everything.
With help. Really, lots of help.
Really appreciate Donna. She's amazing. She's amazing. So, I believe if you have the gold prayer book, page 34. Thank you. I can never quite find it in here. Page 34. And there's, okay, so what I'm looking for is actually there's a slightly different refuge bodhicitta before the teachings. This is the one on page 34 you do in your own practice. And if you look at line 3, do you all know all this? Am I repeating? Everybody knows? No, this is new. Okay. Line 3. This is something, if you're new, now you can say you know this kind of thing. This was one of the first things I learned in Buddhism. It actually gave me a little pride of like, okay. Line 3, by my practice of giving and other perfections. In the Tibetan, Dagi Jinso Gipe Sonamki. Okay? So if you turn to page 98, thank you. These are actually, this is the refuge in bodhicitta before the teaching. Look at line 3. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma. So it's slightly different. And it says Dagi Jin Nyingi Pe instead of Tsogi Pe. So it's just a difference. So we're going to recite the one on page 98. Anyone who cares to. And when you do recite, normally you'd have your hands in prostration mudra out of respect. If you'd like to do that, you can try. We'll recite this once in the English and we'll chant it twice in the phonetics. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Oh, Sangye Chodan Soki Chonam La Janchu Bardu Dagni Kyapsu Chi Dagi Jinningi Pe Sonam Gi Jola Penche Sangye Drupar Jo Sangye Chodan Soki Chonam La Chanchu Bardu Dagni Kyapsu Chi Nagi Jinningi Pe Sonamgi Jola Penche Sangye Drupar Jo. So it's helpful when you do recite prayers to think about the meaning and think about, for instance, I'll just give a bit of a preliminary before we get into compassion and how compassion is helpful. I'm just curious, when you get into trouble in your own life, when you're depressed, anxious, fearful, angry, having a fight with your partner, fed up with your kids, melting down at work, what are your coping mechanisms, please? Anybody? What are your coping mechanisms? Like, what do you take refuge in? Anybody care to say?
Sugar.
Yes. Sugar, and that really helps, doesn't it? Right? Sugar, okay, temporary relief. What else do you do? And thank you for saying sugar. Thank you for being honest. You know, sometimes I'm asking people, and people go, I recite mantras. I meditate on emptiness. I'm like, is that what you, oh, really? That's the first thing that you do? Some people do. But come on, we reach for sugar. We go to the refrigerator.
Talk to a friend.
Talk to a friend, yes, absolutely. Helpful?
Yes.
Yep. So that is helpful. Let's look at that. That is helpful. Long range helpful? They can protect you from more suffering? Right? Interesting. Not always, right? Little bit, There's some temporary relief. We talk to close friends and family, people we trust. We ask for, you know, can you help me? I'm stuck, can you help me? So are their minds limited or unlimited, would you say? Right? Limited, maybe. I mean, again, we may not know their minds. Okay. But generally, are they fully awake like a Buddha? And don't sometimes they advise us based on what they want us to do? They have their agenda, what they think we should do, their own thing. They don't like the partner that you're with, so they're going to advise from there. Or sometimes, don't sometimes they say to us, I don't know what to say? So sometimes we get a little temporary relief, but then the problem is still there. I still need to deal with the problem later. No tools there to... But that often can be some temporary relief, right? Anything else? Meditation?
Vacation.
Vacation. Meditation on vacation or vacation from meditation. I don't know, whichever you're, right? Vacation. We escape, right? And we run to music. We run to driving our cars really fast on the open road. We get into physical exercise, playing with our pets, eating ice cream, going to the movies, watching TV, numbing ourselves out. So you have to check with yourself, are my coping mechanisms and my sources of refuge, are they infallible sources of refuge? Do they really protect me from more suffering? Or is it a temporary relief? So in Buddhism, we take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and we would say it's an infallible source of protection from more suffering. And you would further, through the teachings, study about what are the qualities of the Buddha. What are the qualities of the Dharma? The Dharma would be the philosophy, ultimately the teachings on emptiness, the nature of reality. That's the real refuge, they say. That's the thing that really protects you. So if you do meditate on emptiness, that would be a great coping mechanism. And I have to say, once I do retreat at a remote retreat center often called I go up there often called Laudo, and it is near in the Mount Everest region of Nepal. And in the last 20, 30 years, I've gone up many times to do retreat. And I'm actually leading a pilgrimage there in 2018, if you want to go trekking in Nepal. We have, the group is nearly full, but we have some space if you're interested. And And so when I'm up there, it's very remote, and there's only three or four people that live there that take care of you and bring food. But it's the first few years, it was very foreign than it from anything I knew. And there were times my mind would get depressed, and I'd feel lonely, and I'd be like, what am I doing here? And then I'd just take out one of my books on emptiness and start reading, and that was the end of the loneliness depression. It was very hard to hang on to that. It just somehow transformed. So it's nice to think about when you recite this prayer really what it means. To the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, Supreme Assembly is the Sangha, spiritual community. It could be a center like Kadampa Center. It could be monks and nuns. It could be those who've had a direct perception of emptiness, the nature of reality. And then it says, by the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings, beings with a consciousness is what sentient means, with a mind. So the reason I'm doing this is to protect myself from more suffering. Things could be much worse for me, but also the suffering I'm experiencing now in the human realm is still too much. So it would be great if I could get out of that suffering. But if I do that, there's all these other beings still suffering. So if I could actually become a Buddha, fully awakened being, then unlimited in how I can best lead them out of their suffering to enlightenment as well. So again, in order to benefit all sentient beings. So those four lines, in a sense, contain the entire path. So it's nice to first reflect and then try to recite the words like that. So thank you very much. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about compassion. I want to talk about how do we fully open the heart and awaken the heart. If you can do this, and this is something that takes time and effort, this is a life or a lives practice, okay, you will be happier and more blissful. And in particularly in present days where a lot of people have asked me, what do I think about what's going on politically? And then people try to pull you into their side, right? And I'm not really interested in sides, you know, because if your heart's fully awakened, like His Holiness the Dalai Lama or Lama Zopa Rinpoche, is you're the middle way. You're balanced, centered, right? And we have a lot of work to do, regardless of whosever side you're on, right? If your mind gets swayed one way or another and you find you're angry and you're frustrated with these people and you want to attack those people, and then you're over here and you're fearful about this or you're upset about this person, and if your mind is continually doing that, is there anybody here that's not experiencing that often? Right? We all have that. And that's our humanness. That's the human condition. Human condition is flawed. Sorry to break it to you, okay? I'm not laying a trip on you. I'm just facing reality, meaning as human beings, part of our nature is we make mistakes. We make mistakes. Buddha nature doesn't. So I much more accept that I make mistakes. I didn't used to, and I was really miserable. Okay, because every time I made a mistake, it was like, shouldn't be that, you know, grinding myself. This is natural. So when I make a mistake, I pick myself back up. Okay, I may experience a little bit of, you know, the sorrow and the pain and what happened and that hurt and, right? And then I want to figure out what went on. And so that's where I have to bring in my internal practice, some kind of sitting practice to analyze and evaluate what happened. Why? So I don't do it again. So I can learn from it. Then I grow, and then the mind wiser and more peaceful. That's our path as Buddhists. You may not all be Buddhists here. That's okay. This is for anybody. Is this useful to kind of learn from mistakes, but to also accept ourselves with our limitations? So this all takes, it's a process. It's a process. My biggest challenge when teaching people that live in the United States is we have a culture that wants it delivered instantly, our enlightenment, all wrapped up in a nice little gold box 2 weeks ago, right? And it's just not like that. I'm sorry. So that's the hardest thing when I say to people, I was somewhere teaching. It wasn't New York. It was someplace else before that, I think. And people kept asking me. So after I would explain, and they said, so what's the easy way? Yeah, can you just tell me how I can, like, do it tonight? Can I do it, you know, can I get it by next month? You know, so I think that's a lot. We're setting ourselves up for a lot of frustration. It's just not been the path for me. Okay, I've been on this path for about, this is my anniversary, my 30th anniversary year, in 2 months from my first course 30 years ago. So I see the plateaus, and, you know, you just keep going. You just keep going. And sometimes it's really hard, and sometimes you want to talk yourself out of it. I'm done, like that. And that's why you have centers like this, for people to encourage each other, support each other, and you develop your own Dharma friends like that. So because we have this issue, the awakened heart isn't tremendously always available to us. If you're ever around someone like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, you get a little disarmed, this feeling that he's got no walls up in here, no walls up in his heart-mind space. So there's just this kind of vast, spacious blissfulness around him. And you're very attracted to it, and everybody wants that. And you say, how do I get there? Well, slowly, we work on a little bit. So I want to talk about compassion and how we'll work on it. We'll do these exercises like this practice. I find quite beautiful, reciting some mantras with a certain visualization we will do tomorrow. Okay. Compassion. From the Latin root, it's an English word, from the Latin root, to suffer with. Broadly defined, compassion is a sense of concern that arises when we're confronted with another suffering and we feel motivated to see the suffering relieved. We want to relieve others' suffering. We want to end somebody's suffering. That's kind of the essence of compassion, to suffer with. Okay, we'll talk later also about empathy. In Tibetan, the word ninje, my pronunciation's not that great. Okay, but this is what's interesting about the word ninje. We just say compassion, okay, in Sanskrit, karuna. Okay, but in Tibetan, the literal meaning of it is the king of heart, the king of heart. So it tells you a little bit of the placement in their etymology and in their culture for compassion. This is the Lord overall, is to have the compassionate, fully awakened heart. Okay. And what happens often, I find in Buddhist teachings, and people, I teach around the world, so centers contact me and then they'll say, oh, the next time you come, or I'll say, what do you want me to teach? Because they best know their students. And they'll say to me, well, what do you teach? What would you like to teach? So sometimes I love to do courses on compassion, and people want something juicier, like tantra or emptiness. And then you get, everybody wants to come to that, but then compassion's really the essence. It's certainly the essence of this path, okay? So, and often it talks about, in certain languages, evoking a mother's love for her child is a kind of, in our sense, this kind of archetypal expression of compassion. You know, when you think about a mother's love, you know, not that fathers don't have the love, but that mother's love, okay? So at its core, compassion is a response to the inevitable reality of our human condition, okay? And so this is what's difficult for us, especially Americans. The inevitable reality of our human condition is pain and sorrow. I'm sorry to explain that to you. It's pain and sorrow. Now, it doesn't mean that life isn't joyous, because it is. There's many glorious things about the world we're in, and we can appreciate it right this moment. I appreciate it more now because I understand more about samsara's nature. Okay? Samsara, most of you are familiar. It's a Sanskrit word. Sanskrit word that means to cycle, to turn. We're turning through birth, old age, sickness, and death. Birth, old age, sickness, and death. All of that is suffering. All of that is suffering. If you understand that's the premise that I have come back into, why? Because I haven't had a direct perception of emptiness yet. I don't perceive reality as it really is. I misknow. K-N-O-W. I misknow and misinterpret. Because of that, I come back into a rebirth, or I'm just living through life now, if you don't believe in reincarnation, right? And it's suffering, it's full of pain and sorrow. Okay, now, it's not always full of that, but that's going to pop up. So the reason I said it's most difficult for not just Americans, but a lot of Western culture, is every time the pain and sorrow pops up, we go to one of our coping mechanisms that isn't infallible. Sugar, recreation, and then we have ways. We escape into the movies. We numb ourselves out with TV. Okay? We deny with eating and sugar and folding in on ourselves, depressed from the pain and the sorrow. What if we wake up to the pain and the sorrow and face it, explore it, evaluate it, investigate it, okay? Because the only way through it, the only way past it to fix it is to go through it. So again, it's your choice. Keep tamping it down, pushing it away, ignoring it like that, and it'll keep popping up until we've dealt with it. A lot of you know that about your own life's problems like that. Okay? However, compassion offers the possibility of responding to suffering with understanding, Patience, which is one of the six perfections, which I believe Geshe-la is teaching on which days?
Wednesday
nights, if you're going to that class. And kindness, Compassion offers you this possibility of understanding, responding to the suffering with understanding, patience, and kindness rather than fear and repulsion. So these are your choices. I'd rather have understanding of it. I'd rather have some patience with it. And this involves, it starts with yourself. It starts with yourself. We have an idea, I want to be compassionate to all others. And unless you've understood and explored your own suffering, it will only be superficial, the compassion you're really experiencing. Okay? So compassion lets us open ourselves to the reality of suffering and seek its alleviation. It's what connects the feeling of empathy to acts of kindness, generosity, and our other altruistic tendencies like that. So when compassion arises in us, especially when you see somebody suffering, I just left New York. I was just teaching in New York, and, you know, first of all, it was freezing up there compared to here. It was really cold. And there's people still living on the street. You know, it just pained me. It just, you know, they had their sleeping bags, you know, and then it rained one day. You know, you're on the street. Can you imagine living on the street like that? People walking by you, looking at you funny, you know, anyway, it's just horrible. It's just horrible, right? So, in the three things can happen almost instantaneously when compassion arises, okay, when you see need or you see suffering. You perceive the other's suffering or need, right? We emotionally connect with the need or the suffering, okay? And number three, we respond instinctively by wishing to see the situation relieved. So it can lead to action, this eagerness to want to help, to want to do something for somebody else. It's exciting, right? So I was told tomorrow there is some kind of rally downtown. Is that right? So some people may be going to that. And somebody said there might not be as many people here in the morning, but they're all coming in the afternoon. Whatever, that's fine. So some people have felt that they want to go to rallies. Some people feel not, right? Depending on how, whatever you feel. Some people want to go to these rallies. So I ask people, how are you going to protests? You know, if you use social media, what are you putting on social media? What is the motivation behind that? Because we had a brief motivation, this refuge prayer that we send, and I often start people with some meditation, but I know we have tonight's a little bit short, so I wanted to get into the... But we'll do some more meditation over the weekend. And what's your attitude when you go to these things? I'm just curious. Anybody go to any of the women's marches, or what happened? There's a big one in Raleigh. And did you have an intention when you went? What was your kind of motivation for going? The gentleman in the back. Chris, right? Chris. Sorry, I'm picking on you.
I went just to try to feel better about what was going on with the election that seemed to be a big disappointment for a lot of people, including myself. And hopefully that women would be treated better and not, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't want to say taken advantage of, but just not appreciated as much. That's it. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Yes.
I went to gain comfort by seeing others who were excited to do something.
Okay. Any other?
Yeah, I went because so many people were denigrated during the last year by so many things that were said, that I wanted to show them that not everybody felt that way about them. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tomorrow's HK on J. Oh, can you hear me? HK on J. It's really a big deal in Raleigh every year. Reverend Barber is going to be leading it. And it's a march to stand up for people who can't always stand up for themselves. It's about so many issues this year. It's hard to even name them all. It's been quite a year. But it's about voting rights, justice for everybody, women's rights, which have been
trampled on. I'm just talking about, what's your motivation if you went to one of the marches? Did you have a motivation for...
Getting off my ass.
Okay. So thank you, because some of it is about your own thing, and then some of you had things about others that you were trying to help support others. So I think what I was interested in with the marches, I noticed, was how positive they stayed. They seemed to be quite positive. So if you're going to take your social activism externally, if you're going to have some external response, you could call it activism or whatever, but like, even how are you when you're driving and how are you in the grocery store, what if we have a foundation of kindness there towards whomever we're interacting with? Some kind of positive motivation. There was a woman, we were just in New York, and so we were talking about ways people responded. She said, well, I went to a protest, and she said, but my thought was really about love and connection. Well, that's a great way to go to a protest. Okay, we need to stay connected. This isn't about you're this and you're that and you voted for this person. It's about can we create some kind of healthy dialogue, connection to each other. And remember, there's a human being that's just as flawed as me. That, you know, and if we, I just keep reaching across. My hand is always out, you know, like, because I know somebody's going to be reaching back. And to just keep that positive space there, that's what really makes the world go around in a harmonious way. How many of you are going tomorrow to the, I'm just wondering. Okay, so I'll be here then for the rest of you. No problem, but enjoy. Okay, so just think about this. We emotionally connect with the need or the suffering of the other person. You know, again, there's an immediate connection of, you see somebody suffering, it could be me, you know, or the pain, you know, there's a connection. So that's there at that basic level. And then somehow our delusions keep disconnecting us. That's all that happens. Our delusions keep disconnecting us. What do you mean by delusion? Anger, confusion, fear, jealousy, pride, anxiety, depression. We all have those. And so every time that bubble comes up in my mind, then it's me, myself, and I. And then suddenly I'm like, I can't be bothered with you. Okay? So... okay. So what happens, it's interesting with compassion, and we are basically compassionate creatures. We are basically, that is a fundamental teaching in Tibetan Buddhism. Okay? But it's also supported by scientific study these days. But basically Buddhism says, you have Buddha nature. You have Buddha nature. What it means is a seed or a potential that can ripen into a fully awakened being. And everyone with a mind, with a consciousness, has that. So you might say there's certain evil beings on the planet, and it's certainly, they manifest that way. There's beings on the planet on all different levels that can create enormous harm on the planet, and that does exist. But Tibetan Buddhism, giving the benefit of the doubt, would say yes, there's certainly a side of them that is manifesting horribly. Horribly, right? But they still have a seed that can be awakened into a fully realized being. Right now, very obscured. Okay? And so each of us has our own level of obscuration. And so, very fortunate for you that you got yourself into this room right now. Extremely fortunate that you have the intelligence, the energy, the interest, the curiosity to come here so that your layers of delusion may be much less than the murderer, than the terrorist, like that, than the suicide bomber or the person that goes in and shoots up a school or something. So give yourself some credit, but just understanding, recognizing that seed is in there. So for me, it starts to grow this open. For me to take the shooter, and I think it's just horrible. I mean, for me, one of the most difficult things was Sandy Hook, the school in Connecticut? For me, that was just... it really laid a number on me for weeks, because there were kids, and it was just so hard. But somebody getting that confused somebody that confused. We've all been confused to a degree. Okay? There's somebody really confused. And then the harm. But so my little level of confusion, could you agree with this? Hasn't your little level of confusion at times caused harm on its little level? Like its little level of harm, right? So for me, I'm not that different than the shooter. But what it does, again, it connects me emotionally to the shooter. Because my little level of harm could grow into that. And their big harm, their big level of confusion, could also change and be slowly cleaned and cleaned and cleaned till it's smaller. Okay, so it's something to think about. And when we get into, tomorrow we're going to look at, probably tomorrow or the next day, more formal, traditional Buddhist teachings on developing bodhicitta. But we're not going to talk, this isn't the whole course like that. And when you think of the number one thing I want to mention of one of the methods is all beings have been your mother. All beings have been your mother. And this is the first point on a method called the six-point cause and effect method to develop bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is a Sanskrit word meaning the enlightened attitude. Bodhi is enlightenment. Citta, mind. The mind of enlightenment is, I want to become a Buddha so I can perfectly benefit all living beings. Okay, so in order to develop that, there's two methods, and we will talk about the two methods. The first, more open method, six-point cause and effect method to develop bodhicitta. And the first point is, all beings have been your mother. And you say, what? Okay, how is it possible? Buddhism has a belief in reincarnation. Okay? Not everyone believes in reincarnation. So the way it works in Tibetan Buddhism is we have this thing called the mind. And they don't equate it with the brain because the brain is physical. In Tibetan Buddhism, the mind is not physical. Some of you may have taken these courses on the mind. Not physical. It resides at the heart center in a most subtle form, a subtle form, and a gross form. I'm just going to look at the gross level of mind right now. And I'm just giving you information again. Okay? So please check up on what I'm saying. Like, please, when you leave here, reflect on what I... If you're here with a partner, great, talk about it. But reflect on what I was talking about. Does this really work in my life? Is this really how it is? So the gross level of mind, I know I've talked about this before in here. You entered the door, that door, most of you, when you came in the room, the back door. And you could trace right now, if I asked you to trace from your seat to how you got to your seat from the door, you could clearly go back and say, yeah, well, then I was at the door, and then I looked around the room, and then I said, I'm going to sit there, and then I moved my body there and sat down. Everybody following? So what Tibetan Buddhism says is you can actually trace back from your seat to the door and notice that every moment, every activity, first of all, is propelled by a thought. Every activity of your body is propelled by a thought. Everything that comes out of your mouth is propelled by an activity of a thought that neurological activity from your brain creates that is motivated by the mind. That's what Tibetan Buddhism says. And what it would say is that every moment, you getting to your seat has a preceding cause. And that's preceded by another cause, another cause, another cause. And the causes are located in moments of mind or consciousness. Moments of mind or consciousness. And they propel you to sit down in the seat. So you could say, I was at the door, and let's trace it there. Let's look at the subsequent results now, moving forward. I'm at the door. Can you remember going back to the door? And then your eye consciousness connects with the visual reality of the room. And you look around the room. And that's also propelled by moments of mind. And in that one of those moments, some of those moments on the subtle level start selecting a seat. So first taking in the visual consciousness, taking in the room, then causes you to select a seat. And then the moments of mind selecting the seat, and then there's moments of mind, and that causes moments of mind to start to dictate, I need to get over to the seat, and then moments of mind start to propel, activate the brain to propel the body, to move slowly along the seat, to turn you around, to sit you down. All dictated by moments of consciousness or moments of mind. One causing the next, causing the next, causing the next. So you could say what the moment you stood at the door was the first moment. But we know you have other moments of mind, how you got to the door. So you can go back, 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 and Tibetan Buddhism says there's no first cause in your mind. Why? There's always a preceding cause for that. There's always a preceding cause. There's no first start to your mind. Why? Because that first moment that you're going to say first and label it first has something before it that caused it. And they also say that this particular present moment of mind that happens to be a result of the preceding cause, okay, this result is now the cause of the next moment. And that result is the cause of the next moment. And that result's the cause of the next moment. And it goes on and on and on without any end. Because whatever end you designate is the cause of the next moment. So Tibetan Buddhism says that. So please check your mind. Some of you are familiar with this already. But just check how, you know, the thoughts aren't just random. They don't just pop in there. They have, and some of you have predispositions. Did you ever wonder where they came from? Isn't it interesting? How many of you have kids? Okay. How many kids do you have? Two? Are they, how many years apart? Are they same or different, your kids?
Different.
Very different? How many kids do you have?
One.
One kid? Anybody have more than one kid?
Three.
Three kids, two kids, are they same or different? Completely different? Is your child like you and your partner and their father?
No.
Not at all. Who else has kids? Three kids, who has different, same or different? Isn't that interesting? Right? They have their own karma. They come in with their own mind, with their own moments of stuff going on. It's fascinating. Most people always say to me they're different. You know, there's some traits similar, of course, but totally different. They've got their own trajectory of moments of mind coming from past lives, past causes, past conditions, predispositions that are in there, like that. So it's very interesting to just check your mind and notice we can trace the growth level. Like the door to the seat. We can track that. You can't trace subtle moments. They're harder. You could be in long retreat and you'd start to see some of the subtle fluctuations of the consciousness. Like they say, in a finger snap, 64 fluctuations of the consciousness in that. The mind moving. Okay? That's subtle. Okay? And then there is a most subtle level of the mind. Most subtle. And that's its clear light nature. Something even harder for us to conceive because we go, that's not my mind. My mind is busy. My mind is depressed. My mind is confused and cranky and happy sometimes and busy and you know, distracted. And that's not the nature of your mind. Clear light is its nature that is aware of things. Okay? So slowly, so that's how we could say if the mind, if there goes back, and you say, okay, my conception, that's the beginning of me. Okay, that's the beginning of your body. Because conception's a biological thing with a sperm and an egg. A sperm and an egg are physical in nature, and they create something physical, namely your body. And that can be proven. Okay? And they are, the substance for that is called a most subtle wind. A most subtle wind is physical in nature, like chi in the Chinese system, or prana in the Hindu Ayurvedic system, in Tibetan, lung, wind. And again, the winds exist on a most subtle level, on a subtle level, and a gross level. I'm not going to belabor this too much because we've talked about this in other classes. So the most subtle wind that allows the conception to take place, the mind has a unique ability to mount on that wind and they ride together in that lifetime. The mind comes in and then starts to dictate how that body's going to form, how that wind is going to manifest through that life. Okay, it's all dictated by the mind. Okay, but so you say conception, that was the beginning. It's the beginning of the body, but the mind comes in there with the most subtle wind, like a rider on a horse. Okay, but again, that first moment of mind, if all these other moments had a preceding cause, what about the moment of conception? The mind comes in there. So that would basically indicate a past life. And you could go back and back and back. Tibetan Buddhism teaches that there are countless backs, countless past lives, no beginning to the mind, no end to the mind, and it gives us the idea that we could be, we've been all things before. We've circled around in all different lifetimes, rebirths, forms. So it gives the opportunity, the potential, that all beings have been our mother. All beings have been, I've had different, numerous rebirths. Every rebirth, I had a mother. Some sort of rebirth, I had a mother. Maybe not in my amoebic single-cell organism, okay, but there's things that cause me. But most rebirths, I've had a mother. So think about your relationship with everybody that way. Everyone has the potential to be my mother. So immediately, this is step number one. This is the hardest step of the six-point cause and effect to develop. Right? So this starts expanding. So if you can just an exercise tonight when you leave here, if you can, please remember, okay? Until you come in tomorrow morning, every being you see has the potential to have been your mother in a past life. It nurtured you. Now, you may not have all had good relationships with the mother of this life. I understand that. But think about the mother love in general. Think about other mothers you know that sacrificed everything for their kids. Think about someone else in your life that has that mentoring responsibility like that, nurturing, caring, teaching you everything, bathing you, feeding you, letting you spit up all over them, right? Waking you up in the middle of the night, driving you around to all your school stuff, like that. It just is endless. And they don't even stop when you're adults. It doesn't stop. Always thinking of you first. Always thinking of you first. I remember when my mother died, one of my monk friends lost his mother right around the same time, and he came to me and he said, now, because especially as monks or nuns, if you haven't married, don't have a family, he said, now the person who thinks of you first in the world is gone. I remember him saying, you know, because it's always that mother thing. Not that fathers don't have that, but mothers really, something often comes to your body, there's that kind of experience. So I'd like to think that my teachers got my back, right? The Dalai Lama and Lama Zopa Rinpoche and precious teachers are caring for all of us, are caring for all of us. So something to think about. All these beings have been my mother's potential, that this person nurtured me in that way, cared for me so much, loved me like that. We have that relationship, have the potential that we have that relationship with everybody. Okay? So when you drive home, how do you drive? Pretty peaceful when you drive? Okay, some people are chuckling, a little uncomfortable there. Some people are good about it. So think about that. Somebody's getting in front of you. Where's the mind then at that moment? Yeah, are you having your little pocket of confusion there when somebody just in front of you and they didn't put their signal on? My little, you know, why? If it's your mother, wouldn't you let her in? Yeah. What if it was your old mother? What if it was your old mother having struggling driving? You know, of course you'd let her in. So these are just ways, you know, sometimes we joke because it's uncomfortable. We laugh a little bit because it is uncomfortable. And we think, So please go out there and practice and see how it works with your mind. Okay? So what happens is sometimes our culture tells stories. Our culture loves sensational stories. We just saw this last year with the election. Okay? And the stories say that at heart, we are selfish. We're aggressive, selfish creatures. And every person for themselves, dog eat dog. Right? Okay? That's just one story. So again, please protect your mind with what you're taking in. And if you want to stay glommed on to a lot of news like that and a lot of sensational media and things like that, you start believing that after a while. That's what goes in. You have a choice of what kind of magazines and books you read and things like that. Okay? So, and in that case, you would be a little adverse to other people. What's in it for me? I need to take care of myself. And if I am on the street driving, I'm not going to let you in. Because the story I have going is that we're aggressive by nature and it's all people for themselves and you know. So this is about awakening the heart. So that story, please check that story. Is the story accurate? We see some aggression on the planet. No doubt. Why? It's samsara. That's samsara's nature. So those things are going to rise up at times and show their faces to us. You can get out of samsara. You need to know you can get out of samsara and reach liberation. Liberation is nirvana. It's not enlightenment in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. Nirvana is not enlightenment, but it is basically a complete ending of all your mental delusions. So that would be pretty nice. Okay? A permanent cessation of all your mental suffering. Okay? You okay? Okay. Hang in there. It gets better, I promise. Okay. So the trick here is, and then the other thing is, we like to be independent. We like to be independent beings. This country, for white people, was founded on independence. I find it really interesting culturally how countries got started. And basically, for white people, not the native people here, there were people here in the States before us, but for the white people that came, the country was founded on independence. Okay? But the problem with independence is it separates us a little bit. Okay? There's a better word, interdependence. What if we think about interdependence, because it better relates to opening the heart? Interdependence. We're actually deeply interdependent. And our welfare is completely intertwined with everyone else's welfare. It doesn't seem like that. When I have my own house with my own washer and dryer, my own driveway, my own car, my own refrigerator and things like that. Okay, but where did any of those things come from? And sometimes people in cities forget that. You know, and even suburban areas kind of promoted it. When my parents both lived in Philadelphia in the city, which is where I'm based right now, and then the suburbs broke open in the 50s. And the suburbs got developed in all different areas of the country, and then they moved out, and it was really exciting for people to have their own little space, and then it became like my own stuff. And then I needed my own washer and dryer, my own car, my own this, my own that. Everybody got their own lawnmower and their own, you know, hedge trimmers and things like that. And I have friends now that a community, a neighborhood, and they share those things. So it makes it more economical and more, and you rely on other people. So you know you need to kind of trim the lawnmower, make sure you get the lawnmower blade sharpened and stuff, because you know it's not just your own, you can keep it rusted in the garage, it's that other people are using it. So you want to take care of it. A little bit more communal or community living. But there are suburban communities that do that. Like that. So this interdependent nature. And it totally changes the way we view, and not only view the world, but behave in the world. Okay, so the stories that are told to you, based on media and all the other distractions, the stories you tell each other based on that, okay, very much matter. Very much matter. So I'm not just going to ask you to analyze me and investigate what I'm saying. Please analyze those stories. Analyze those stories. I just was talking to David and Elise. They're hosting me very kindly this weekend. And thank you to all the people that have hosted me every time I come. And I was talking about, I sometimes go to India in the winter for some teachings with the Dalai Lama. And I came back last February, a year ago, and I stay with my elderly father. So I don't watch a lot of news, but he watches the, we decided we'd watch together, he watches news a lot, but the half an hour of nightly news, you familiar with that half hour that comes on of international news more? One of them's called, I said to David and Elise, World News Tonight, right? Does anybody watch these shows? Half an hour, okay. So we were watching, and because I we used to work in politics and lived in Washington, D.C. for a while, and then I worked for an investigative magazine. So I'm very careful now. I'm very curious about where the news comes from. Where'd you get the information? Somebody says to me, oh, I heard, I heard that diabetes can be, you know, and I'll say, where did you get the information from? Where did you read that? Because I want to know, because there's a lot of caca out there, okay? Really, so my dad and I, over the course of 3 days, I watched the half an hour with him, because I can't tolerate a lot of it, but I watched the half an hour, right? It's like brainwashing. And I watched, and one of them's called World News Tonight. So 3 nights, World News Tonight had a 10-second spot from the Mexican president last year. All of the rest of it was domestic news. World News Tonight. So this is where Americans are getting their news. You're not getting enough information. You know, and the information you're getting, it's a very narrow little focus. And then you go off, and then you see this narrow focus, and then you grab your friends, and you together look through that little hole like that. And you go, there's the world. So that doesn't contribute to this opening. It contributes to fear, anxiety, suspicion, me, myself, and I'm in this by myself, don't help anybody, I don't like this person, I don't like people to do that. Okay? So more than ever right now, we need compassion. We really need to kind of wake up to this, okay? And the world gets smaller based on our technology, based on our technology. And the other thing is our technology, and you've heard this again and again, is keeping us from expanding here sometimes, because we are addicts to our technology. You know, yes, I've got a computer in front of me right now, but because I, right, because I teach around the world now, I found my friends kept saying to me that teach, they're like, get it on your, I'm carrying books around and huge materials of stuff, all these pages, and they're like, put it on your computer. So it took me a while to adapt, but now I'm doing better with it. So there's positive things I think our technology can serve, and then you just have to make sure that you're just not an addict to it, that you're just constantly sitting in your box, in the phone. You know, there's a whole world out here. There's people that need help. There's beautiful things to look at. Like that. Okay, let me read from His Holiness, the Karmapa. And I love this title. This is his new book. If you haven't read this, it's just coming out. Interconnected, Embracing Life in Our Global Society. This is us awakening our heart. This is the title of the book, Interconnected, Embracing Life in Our Global Society. Let me just read this from him. I really like this. It is possible and realistic for every person to experience real freedom. The reason we have not managed to do so is we lack an understanding of what real freedom is and how it can be achieved. We need the wisdom to distinguish the egocentric pursuit of self-interest from the pursuit of authentic freedom. So in speaking just about freedom right now, it reminds me of a funny thing at Light of the Path. So Light of the Path, as most of you know, is this tremendous retreat that Kadampa Center holds and offers and serves the community with. Thank you to Donna and many other people that make it possible. It's unbelievable. It's been 4 years. This is the fifth year? Fifth year. And it was expanded to a month. So I know it's in Asheville and it's far and people don't understand Lama Zobram Shen. I understand all that. If you just go for a weekend, you sit with a master, I think it does some positive cellular change. That's my feeling, okay? But the thing is, one time I was there with an old friend of mine, and there's like 200 to 300 people. And we were in the back, and he's really a great yogi. He's really somebody special, this lay practitioner. And he turned to me, and he's very funny, right? And we were looking at everybody sitting, and he turned to me. He turned to me, and he said, hey, how many people here do you think really want to be free? Right? So, and I thought about it because we have this word freedom. We love this word. It's a lot of what, again, for white people, this country was founded on, freedom, okay? To be free. There's nothing really freer than for white people in America. I believe I've been around the world and nobody has it freer than us. Really, it's an amazing grace you have. Please don't take it for granted. It's so precious. Not everyone on this planet has it, and certainly not everyone in this country. We have it. Most of us have it. It's extraordinary. Okay? So then we have different relationships with freedom. And Tibetan Buddhism says you could be completely free of all your delusions, problems like that. So, and then what happens is we're not interested in that. So interesting, you know, and then people come to teachings on emptiness, and then they hear about, and where's Jill? We were at the retreat with Venerable Rene last year, and then Rene and I always talk about this when he's a monk friend of mine, he's a wonderful yogi, and we were talking about, you hear all these teachings on emptiness, the nature of reality, the real view, and you realize that that's what frees you. But you're not going to spend more time pursuing that? Like, it's a given. It's done. So anyway, you have to check up on that. Check up what makes you feel really free. When do you feel free? How fleeting is the freedom? What if you could have lasting freedom? So it is interesting. And I like when he says, distinguish the egocentric pursuit of self-interest, which is most of our country, from the pursuit of authentic freedom. To continue on the karmapa. Are we all familiar with the Karmapa? Do we know? Okay, if you're not sure who he is in his 30s. Is that right? In his 30s? I think so. So he escaped. Was he 16 when he escaped? I can't remember. He was in Tibet, felt that his education could not be furthered because of the communist Chinese, was not free at all. And basically, his attendants and people arranged for him to escape to India. And he came out maybe 15 or so years ago or longer, to Dharamsala, India, and he set up below Dharamsala at Gyoto Monastery, and he actually has audiences there a couple times a week if you're there, and he's going to be a huge teacher for us in the future. He's magnificent, and really, you know, for the lineage of Tibetan Buddhism to remain and to be a spokesperson for the tradition, I think he'll be a great force in the world. He's beautiful. There's a bit of a controversy. There's two Karmapas, but I'm talking about the one that we really identify with. I'm not sure. I haven't met the other one, but this is from the one who's got this book. Let me go on with what he said. Sometimes he teaches in the West as well. When I hear what people say about freedom sometimes, it sounds to me like longing to live out the fantasy of being independent and absolutely autonomous individuals, of being free of consequences and responsibilities. That is to say, exempt from the principle of interdependence. Okay. Don't you have that a lot? Like, I just want to have my house. I don't want to have to work anymore. I'll have financial independence, and I can do whatever I want, and I got my house. And then we forget that then the aging process happens. And then vulnerability seeps in. And then I can't see very well. And now I can't drive anymore. And then, or sometimes you just need help from somebody. But when you're living in that bubble, I see it with my father will be 90 next month. And he's good, touch wood, right? He's okay. And he can manage right now. But my mom was the connector. She was the social being. He was not. So he doesn't really have any passage or familiarity of reaching out. We have a wonderful neighborhood, wonderful neighbors. And he just doesn't, he's uncomfortable. It's not something he could do. So it's very challenging for him now. You know, when I'll say, can you, you know, yesterday it snowed, and I make sure he's not, you know, he's going to shovel and he's going to end up with his 2 feet up. That'll be the end. So I said, you can't shovel anymore. It's just, I said, come on. Just silly. You know, there's people that can shovel. So I got the neighbors and I said, you just need to call so-and-so. And he knows, and just call him. But my father hates doing that. It's just not. But I try to get him to reach out to understand there's, you know, it's helpful for him to socialize. It keeps him more cognitively there. And you will notice that as you get older. So, unless you're in like a long retreat or something, that's a little different. Okay. So, but this idea of being free of consequences and responsibility, exempt from the principle of interdependence, the Karmapa says, but there is no such thing. We cannot exist outside causality or outside the connections of interdependence. And so freedom cannot be a matter of escaping from those connections. Only freedom developed on the basis of a realistic view of who we are and how we relate to others can be authentic and extended universally to all. If we acknowledge our interdependence and take into account the vast networks of interconnections in which our lives and actions are embedded, we will find that our own freedom is inseparable from the freedom of all other people. When we truly appreciate this fact, we experience interdependent freedom, a freedom that does not detract from others' freedom. This is a freedom we can all enjoy together without conflict. So please think about that in the future for when I want to do something. Is it just for my own benefit that I'm just in this for myself or just me and my family? Or is there a way I can share a little bit more with others or consider bringing this other person with us today or getting another can of food for this person, or I can actually get the groceries for her if she can't get out today. And in many ways, I can give that person a ride right now. There's so many ways we can just expand a little bit out, because I promise you will be happier doing it. But a lot of our culture isn't practiced doing that. You know, a lot of you do it and volunteer and things. But somehow we do end up in this thing of like, no, I got to take care of my thing. And we lose a little bit of that dimension. Oh, any questions or comments based on what I was saying? I realize this is zipping by. It's helpful. Something to think about. Because I know there's a lot of terms, and if you're newer, it's like, oh, there's a lot of information that I will go through in the weekend. Any questions, comments?
Yeah. I was just going to say that I think, you know, this fact of asking for help. I come from a German family, and they didn't like asking for help. In our family, it really was a sign of weakness. And I think this whole Horatio Alger sort of idea of how one is successful in our country lends itself to the idea that if you're asking for help instead of dominating the other person, you're asking for help from them, that shows perhaps weakness in a weakness of character as well.
Yep. Okay, so check the story. That's the story. The story is, I grew up with crying never helps. That was a storyline in my family. Crying never helps. So I just kept it all in for years. And then the other thing I notice, do you ever see, you know, this happens some at Dharma centers, you're meeting with somebody and somebody starts crying. There's some real thing that's going on. Somebody in your family starts crying. Somebody lost somebody. Somebody died, you know, and they start crying, and then they immediately say, I'm sorry. Why are you sorry when you're crying? It's a story. It's a story that we're told that you can't cry. I feel it for men in our culture. It's not really okay. A lot of men feel like it's not okay to cry because it's a sign of weakness. I love that the Dalai Lama cries. He'll cry. Something will happen. He cries openly. The next moment, blows his nose really loudly into the microphone. And then laughs about it. Like, because that is life. It's sad. You can cry. You grieve. You move on. Like, the story is there. I tell you about the pain, and I wake up. You know, and I mainly, in doing that process, I keep this open. As soon as I go, I'm sorry, it's not okay to cry. And the same thing you said. It's not okay to ask for help. It was a huge one when I moved to Vajrapani Institute to run this center. Rinpoche asked me to run this retreat center. I was a city girl. In the city, you act like you don't need any help. Everything's there. But all these people are making the city run. I'm not there in a bubble by myself in the city. But I could manage. I didn't really need to ask anybody. In the city, you can be more independent. But at this retreat center in the Redwoods, if a tree went down across the driveway, I needed to find somebody with a chainsaw to cut it up. To carry my propane tanks up the hill for the cabin. I couldn't carry them myself. It killed me to ask for help. Killed me. Because that's how I was raised, like that as well. So then I realized how beneficial. Once I got used to it, I wrote a new story. Because I can help others, they can help me, and by the way, that's how the merry-go-round goes around. That's how it functioned harmoniously. So check your stories. What have your parents told you? What did their parents tell them? And you're raised with that kind of stuff. It's in your cells. It's in your genes. And you can write new stories. So another word we're going to talk about also later to explore is vulnerability, which relates to the weakness. Vulnerability. When I say vulnerability, you do, just in general, any words pop up?
Weak.
Weak. Anything else?
Shame.
Shame. Sorry, what was the last one?
Exposed.
Exposed. Not very positive words, right? Would you say they're positive? Okay. So anybody read any Brené Brown? Right? She talks about vulnerability. Vulnerability, she says, is the birthplace of, who remembers? Innovation, creativity, and change. That all sounds very positive to me. Innovation, creativity, and change. You can watch a TED Talk, but she has several books out. Several books out that I like. I'm going to use a little bit this weekend, some of her stuff, bring in some of her stuff. So it reframed vulnerability for me. Now my father's stuck in vulnerability and is not able to totally rewrite his story. I accept that. That's hard. World War II generation like that. But I looked at vulnerability and went, huh, I used to think it was weakness. You're afraid. Oh, you have to ask somebody for help. You're folding in on yourself. You can't do something. You know, so you innovate. You get creative. You change something. You know, the system's not working the way it is. Let it break down. Sometimes that's the best thing that can happen. I've heard people say, she had a breakdown. She had a breakdown. You know, it's a dirty word. She had a breakdown. You know, sometimes it's good. The system, the way it was working, was not working. So it broke down. And it can be really good if you are able to put it back together in a new way, a new improved way. So it's something to think about with vulnerability, to just reframe the kind of things. To continue on with Tibetan Buddhism, and some of this I'm pulling from also, has anyone read Thupten Jinpa, A Fearless Heart? His beautiful book about the compassion training that he's done, I think he helped found the Center for Compassion Training at Stanford in California, but he is a professor at McGill University in Montreal, and he is the interpreter for His Holiness the Dalai Lama when His Holiness teaches in the West. He used to be a monk for many years. And in the book he talks about his letting go of the vows and what happened. He wanted to have a family and how, difficult that was for him initially and things like that. So, A Fearless Heart, it's really a beautiful book of some practical exercises and things of compassion. Fundamentally, Tibetan Buddhism says we are good. Fundamentally, we are good. So even though samsara contains pain and sorrow and loss and problems and suffering, fundamentally, because we have Buddha nature, it's a seed that can awaken, that has fully manifest infinite compassion, wisdom, loving kindness. Fundamentally, we are good. So it's quite a different story that is written than in the Judeo-Christian cultures that a lot of us were raised in. You know, and for me, that was an interesting one, looking at that, is we're good? You know, really fundamentally, we start there, okay? And the other thing is scientists have proven from studies in child development, from primate studies, neuroscience, okay, that we're not just actually self-seeking, competitive creatures, but we are caring, cooperative beings. Okay, I mean, there was one study, I think Jinpa mentions this, where kids were told about, it was an exercise in helping people, and then there was no reward system, but these certain kids that they put into this thing about cooperation, then they said they were late and they had to go, or something about, okay, the class is over. And some of them, most of them naturally stayed to help the teacher. Somebody said, but I still need help with this. And they all, and like naturally, they found that it is a tendency for people to actually show up like that. Now, we say there's some things on the planet that are manifesting differently, but fundamentally, I like to believe that, for instance, the shooter at Sandy Hook, I just think was phenomenally confused and distraught. You know, we get isolated, we get lonely, alienated, and then other stories start turning. You know, mental imbalance, who knows something more serious, a real mental illness, so, you know, and then the next thing you know, I mean, people commit suicide, and you think, why would somebody do that? Right? Because utter confusion. You know, you can even say he wasn't in his right mind. You're right. He wasn't touching the Buddha nature. It's there, but not as aligned with it. Not as aligned. So we're trying to open up the heart to be more aligned with that. Okay, I find it gives me a lot of hope. And the other thing that's interesting with neuroscience, through brain imaging technologies, they're noticing more about what they call brain plasticity, how our brain physically changes in response to our environment and experiences throughout our lives. Researchers are also beginning to understand how conscious mental training, such as meditation, affects our brains for the better. There's proof now that they're showing. When you meditate on compassion, how these neural pathways get opened up that create more kindness, more humility, more interconnection, like that. So why wouldn't we want to do those exercises like that? So you can literally, I think with meditation and things, change your brain. You're not stuck with who you are. Your basic pattern and behavior will be the same, but you can be happier. So aren't most people interested in that? Okay. And I would just say, are you up for this? And Thupten Jinpa goes into this. Are you up for this? Okay. Compassion gives you a sense of purpose beyond your habitual petty tendencies. Okay. Lightens your heart. It lifts your stress. Okay. Makes you more patient with an understanding of not only others, but yourself. You already know this. You know this kind of stuff, okay? Gives your mind an alternative to anger and other reactive states, which also has been shown to be incredibly helpful for veterans with PTSD. People like that. And not even veterans with PTSD, other people with PTSD. Compassion makes you less lonely, less afraid, and in a nice twist, you end up benefiting from other people's kindness towards you. So you are compassionate, you'd be unbelievable how many people will be kind back. That's how it works. That's how it often works. Okay, however, you can't expect that. Can't expect it. Better not to have any expectations. Okay, I always find expectation is the mother of disappointment, right? Okay. So, this is attributed to the Buddha. What is the one thing which when you possess, you have all other virtues, compassion. It's one of the best kept secrets of happiness. And from Jinpa's a fearless heart embraces this fundamental truth of our human condition, that there's pain and suffering. We all know that, okay? We can develop the courage to see and be more compassionately in the world, to live our lives with our hearts wide open to the pain and joy of being human on this planet. Okay, it's important he says, and joy, okay? It's not all pain, okay? As utterly social and moral creatures, we each yearn to be recognized and valued. We long to matter, especially in the lives of those whom we love. We like to believe that our existence serves a purpose. We are meaning-seeking creatures. It's through connecting with other people, actually making a difference to others, and bringing joy into their lives that we make our own lives matter and that we bring worth and purpose to our own lives. This is the power of compassion. So it's very interesting to think of the words hearts wide open to the pain and joy of being human on the planet. So a little exercise tonight as well for yourself is just reflect on, if you plan to come back, to reflect on what does it mean to me to have my heart wide open to pain? You know, how can I do that? We will talk about that in here through the weekend, how we do that. It's scary for us initially, first. It's very difficult for us because we're will happen to us? Will we die? That doesn't usually happen just because you have your heart open to the pain you're experiencing of yourself and others. So it is an interesting trajectory because the main part is when you are facing it, when you're able to face it, okay, that's the way through. Because mostly we're, again, turning, ignoring. It's going to show up at some point, and you don't want it showing up when you're dying, where you haven't looked at it yet. So think about the... And the other part is the meaning-seeking creatures. And Jim has this really nice thing in his book about... It's something about our modern culture. And we are a culture, and let's say in the States, of human doings, right? We're always doing, rather than human beings. We're a little bit uncomfortable in our skin to just be, right? So we're doing. We're doing. Those of you that have kind of weekly Monday through Friday jobs, how many people roughly? Number of people? You come in on Monday, what do your coworkers say? How was your weekend? What did you do? You have to have your list of what you did. You know, when I would like do my little mini retreats on the weekend, or did you ever have a weekend you didn't do anything? Don't you love those weekends? Don't we need those weekends? Right? And if you came in and you go, I didn't really do anything, and then your coworker would be like, oh, like it wasn't good? It's my best when I don't do anything. So when I do retreat, if I go to Lauda or someplace else, do retreat, I have like a retreat structure, and it's busy. It's full with these meditation sessions, what I'm doing, right? And it's hard. You've got other stuff, activities, you know, when you need to get clean, and you've got some meals, and maybe you want to read, and it tends to be a bit busy. And then somehow in the evening, it always ends up the evening tea. I don't usually have a meal in the evening. Evening tea, and it's a half an hour. I get my tea, and this is at Lauda. They'll deliver the tea, right? And then if it's light out, because the last time I was there was the summer, so there was a lot of light in around 7 in the evening, and I would just prop myself. I had a little bank of windows. I'd prop myself up by the windows, and I just had a half an hour to stare out the windows. Just look out the fog, the scenery, the trees, birds, and I just would just watch my mind. Sometimes just watch the mind, little idea would pop up, go back in the mind. But, oh, look at that. Just to space out. I think you need those times. Just need those little bit of break, but we don't give ourselves much of a break. So I think it's really helpful to think about. And so he said that when he was growing up and a child in his family, he was very valued by the family just based on being an individual. But with us, it's kind of different. And I lived in Washington, D.C. for many years. It was very much like, who do you work for? You work for them. Oh. You know, where do you live? Where do you live? You know. But you see, it's these kind of things that you're valued on the car you drive, how much money you make, what kind of clothes you wear, what kind of bag you have. You know, where you've traveled, what, really. And he just said it was just enough to be a human being on the planet, so valued. And I don't know if this is the case, but what I notice with my Sherpa and Tibetan friends raising school-age kids, I just visited a family in New York, Rinpoche's cousins, how their family, how respectful the kids are to the parents, to their elders. Is it like that with your kids? When they were teenagers? Somewhat? Right? It's different in our culture. I find there's really this kind of challenging time most of my friends go through with the teenage kids when the bottom of the respect kind of falls out. But not the Tibetan Sherpa families I know. And I don't know if it's because of the value. It's not like you don't value your kids, but there's just so much that's doing. And then what has to be accomplished. hurdles, meaning even getting those clothes and getting that thing and getting the, and for them, they're, you know, they're getting their kids educated. And, but it's, there's kind of simplicity. And they all work really hard. The parents work really hard and they just bought a house and, but there's something like they're all in it together, doing this together. And the kids would never, I've never experienced one little piece of sass from the kids. You know, and I study, like, why is it like that? And it's a cultural thing. So because they all do it, not one kid would speak out, but with our kids, one kid speaks out, another one sees, another one sees. So it's cool to dish your parents. I guess. I don't know. You know, I did it. My niece and nephew, I mean, I've told the story here before. My niece, she's in her mid-20s now. She's great. She was maybe, I don't know, 14, something. I ran into her mom in a big store. I ran into her mom, my sister-in-law, and I said, hey, and my sister-in-law said, the kids are here, and I said, oh, and my sister-in-law took her phone, pushed her daughter, my niece, to put me on the phone and handed me her phone. What comes up for my niece on her phone? Mom. How did she answer the phone? Yeah. What? What is that? It's your mother. How dare you? I felt like, so then, and then it was me. So I said to her, we get on really well, and so I hear, what? And I said, well, good afternoon to you, bundle of sunshine. And then there's this pause, and she said, oh, hi, Aunt Amy. And I later said to her, I said, what was that about for you? What was, I'm just wondering what was going through your mind. And she's aware. She goes, I don't know. She goes, I notice I do that. I know it's not okay, but I do it. And I said, well, at least you're aware. I said, that's the beginning, is to show up for your mind and realize I'm screwing up right now. Okay, my eyes are open. Don't want to do this. I said, so maybe you need to take it back a step, close your eyes when you're quiet for a moment, and rehearse a new way of doing it. Because that's what we do in meditation. You have a tangle with somebody, you can't deal with it right then, they're totally pissing you off, you need to take it back to your cushion. There's my external work, here's my internal work. Take it back to my cushion, and I need to, first of all, investigate what happened. What was my motivation, their motivation? Why did I get pissed off? What did I think they wanted? What's it like to be them? Are any of us, are we accomplishing at all what we wanted? And then you role play a new behavior that's more positive. And you might have to do it again and again and again. And you practice and rehearse and rehearse until one day you're back in your external work with the person who annoys you and it automatically gets activated. That's why we call it practice. That's what we have to do. Have to practice. Possible? Try your best? Okay. So another thing I'd like you to think about tonight is making meaning in life. This will keep your heart open and create a fully awakened open heart. What gives meaning to your life? Some of you are completely clear about that. Some of you have no idea, have never thought about it. So please start thinking about it now. Don't wait until you're dying. And because what's exciting is if you think about it now, right, and you realize this is, what I mean is, when are you deeply content? Not just having a good time and this is great. When are you deeply content? When you go to sleep at night and you know this was a good day. What is feeding that in you? Because you can then direct your life that way, more and more and more. Absolutely positive. And you really need to do that for the planet, because you'll be happier. And you'll be an example for others. So we'll talk about that the next couple of days. Any other questions, comments? So please, you've got reflecting on all beings have been your mother. I'm making a few notes so I don't forget. Finding meaning in life, what gives your life meaning? And was there a third thing I mentioned?
What does it mean to have your heart open?
Yeah, to have your heart open to pain. Like, you know, what would make it bearable for you? What doesn't work about it? I mean, we're pretty clear what doesn't work, I think, but what is so scary about it? Will you not survive that? What would help support you in that work like that to help you go through there? And maybe you've had experiences, I'm sure many of you, in the past when you've had to hang there with the pain. What's that experience like for you? It can be a very, very powerful place of tremendous transformation for the positive. Everybody okay? Shutting my technology. I'd like to dedicate. So in closing, whatever positive energy we've created, we dedicate it, basically investing it in our being able to wake up as much as we can to hold this place of this juicy space at our heart that is interconnected to all beings. Being able to care for ourselves in the process so we can care for all others, and may it help move us along a path to full awakening, to becoming Buddhas, as then we're completely unlimited in benefiting all others. I'd like to dedicate in that way. And if we can just turn to page, where's the other little prayer? The dedication prayers. Oh, page 235. We'll read these three prayers. If you have the gold prayer book, just look on if you don't have it. We'll read these in English, just these three verses. Page 235. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow. May that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. Just as the brave Manjushri and Samantabhadra too realize things as they are, I too dedicate all these merits in the best way that I may follow their perfect example. Page 244, the long life prayers for His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Lama Zopa Rinpoche.
Oh, gari rawe ko we shing kam de bendang de wa malu chung we ne chen re zi wang ten jing gao tso yi sa pe si te ba du ten gyo jing.
You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. Is this the prayer for, that's for Geshe-la's teacher, right? Okay. Anyway, thank you very much. Thank you so much for coming, and I hope to see you tomorrow or the next day. And if you're interested, if you're not coming back, I have a website, amymiller.com, and there are a number of teachings on the website. It's connected to a YouTube channel, if that's helpful for you. I have some cards I can leave, and if you're interested in the pilgrimage 2018, there's information on the website about that. Thank you.